Hi everyone, I'm Pamelia Chia and you're listening to the Singapore Noodles Podcast, your go-to destination to learn about Singaporean food culture. Today I have on the show Mandy Yin, who is the founder of Sambal Shiok, which is a laksa bar based in London. She's also the author of the cookbook Sambal Shiok, which is a collection of Malaysian-inspired recipes. In the following conversation, we chat about how Sambal Shiok came about and her journey of following her passion. It's a beautiful book, and as a Singaporean reader, I just felt so proud reading it because all of the dishes that I grew up eating is just presented in such a beautiful way.
That's really nice to hear because, I wrote this book during the lockdowns of last year, and so when I realized that we weren't going to be able to travel, I wasn't going to be able to get home for a long time, maybe for years. This book was really therapeutic for me to write because it gave me a lot of connection to home and, you know, memories and comfort. But at the same time, I always knew I wanted to make it really beautiful to look at. Mm. I wanted it to be a coffee table book as well as a cooking resource because I wanted it to really bring Malaysia to the readers as well as giving, you know, comfort to other Southeast Asians in the Western diaspora.
Yeah, did you feel like there was a gap in the market when you first decided to write this book?
Oh yes, of course. I mean, you know, like I can only think of less than a handful of sort of Malaysian or Singaporean books that have been published by Western publishers. So of course, you know, we all have many cookbooks that have been published in the East, but nothing here, you know, and I just thought, why is that? And so, yeah, I'm doing my best to fly the flag.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, even with Singaporean cookbooks, I don't think there are many on the global market that are really written for, say, a white audience as well as people back home, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just feel that your work is really groundbreaking and it's, you know, so representative of the kind of food that we eat because it's not just about the greatest hits, not just about chicken rice or laksa. Was it something that you were very mindful of?
Definitely. I mean, you know, I can only write about my experience, my experiences, mm-hmm. my food memories of growing up and what which dishes are important to me. So yes, you know, I have sort of a few hawker center favorites, including of course my signature laksa, asam laksa. But like Malaysian food is just so wide, as you know, like Singaporean, like everyone, you know, so maybe they know, like, for example, rendang or satay, but there's so much more. Yes, I've hung my hat on laksa. My mission is to make laksa as widespread, well-known as like Thai green curry or pad thai, you know. But otherwise, so yes, I certainly try to put other dishes that I standard bearers in our cuisine on the menu just so that people come to understand the flavors. Like for example, my Malaysian fried chicken with peanut sauce. I mean, you're not going to find that in Malaysia. That is not a thing. But at the same time, it's really grounded in our flavors. You know, I used the rempah that usually marinates the satay for the chicken, and then we coat it with a spiced gram flour mix, you know, and that was inspired by vade. I love vade. And so, you know, it's just twisting things a bit, like a bit like what our, you know, ancestors did when they first moved to Malaysia, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm doing sort of the same because I've lived in London for most of my life now. And it's based on what I like to eat and what sort of what I remember and sort of what I think also is accessible to people, you know, here. I'm not saying I'm dumbing down the flavors, not at all. But so, for example, on my menu is I don't actually use a lot of Malay or Chinese words because I want people, potential customers, just to be able to look at the menu and conceptually quite easily understand what we're selling. And that's it. It's not that, you know, I'm not proud of what we have, but it's just like trying to bridge that gap
I realized that when I was flipping through your cookbook. I mean, I saw this recipe for mussels.
Yes, masak nanas, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that that was so fantastic because I love mussels and that's definitely something that I would cook, you know. So I really love that playful approach. But I was wondering if you felt any pressure to produce something that was like super authentic, you know, similar to what people would get back home in Malaysia and Singapore 100%. Because, I mean, that is something that people always talk about when it comes to cooking or cookbooks from our region.
I hate the word authentic. It's a troublesome, problematic word because it's so subjective to whoever it is who's using that word, okay? Mm-hmm. So I've never described my food as authentic. So in the traditional sense, you know, you're not going to, like I said, you're not going to find many of the things in my book in Malaysia and Singapore. But my food is authentic to me. It's genuine to my experiences. Yes, if you want to find like really traditional recipes, you can find that online. You know, you can find that in other books. But from my point of view, like, yes, there are a few more traditional recipes, like, for example, like jia kui jiao or wat dan ho in the book, because I love them, like your bak kut teh, for example. But at the same time, I'm not tied to traditional ways. For example, like I don't use a pestle and mortar for pounding rempah. Like, sorry, I just don't have the time. And at the restaurant, you know, we make like at least 40 kilos of laksa paste every week. It's just not possible. Mm. Otherwise, I would have to sell my laksa for like double the price because of the labor cost. So, you know, it's long story short, I'm not tied at all to being authentic in, you know, the traditional sense.
Yeah, when I read your cookbook, I thought that it was almost like a memoir of sorts where you kind of traced your journey going from growing up in Malaysia to moving abroad. I was just wondering, how did you manage to learn? I mean, when I read your cookbook, I was astounded because, you know, there are so many hawker classics or things that takes so long to master, things like roti prata or roti canai, or even things like making the curry puffs. So what was that journey like for you learning how to cook heritage food?
But actually, those two things, roti canai and those spiral curry puffs, I learned to do in the lockdown. Honestly, I've spent years trying to crack roti canai. Honestly, years. You know, there's so many recipes for it, but I just couldn't get it. And of course, last year was highly traumatic, being a restaurateur, and you know, I had to close the restaurant. And I decided to make the most use of that time of the restaurant's closure to try to make it a positive time, which is why I really dedicated myself to all these recipe testing. My husband and I, we ate roti canai for a week solid, lunch and dinner, because whilst I was trying to crack this recipe, because, you know, so many recipes do call for example, egg or condensed milk. But I was like, I'm sure hawker, like, you know, the mama hawker stores do not use expensive ingredients like eggs. There's no way. So, you know, I was so happy when I figured out, like, okay, this is the trick to it. And frankly, like, like most of us, I use the internet. I, you know, research like possible recipes. And then it's just like cooking, right? You just have to test and put in that time. So now I'm really like, actually, the roti canai recipe, I say to people, if you buy this book for one recipe, that is the one for those of us who know it. And likewise, like curry puffs, for example, I didn't know how to make them before. I didn't even know how to pleat curry puffs 18 months ago.
Oh, wow.
But again, I spent, you know, that time like watching YouTube videos, like trying learning how to pleat. Like I'm actually very, very bad at dumpling and pleating. So, you know, pleating curry puffs was quite a challenge for me. But yeah, I did it. And now, like at the restaurant, we serve curry puffs as well. Not the spiral ones, the single short crust pastry instead. But I'm really pleased that I've been able to pass on that knowledge to my team. And now people, you know, they come to us for the curry puff. So it's funny, like COVID, you know, yes, it was horrible, but there's lots of silver linings.
Yeah, I love that. Like Singapore Noodles was born during the pandemic as well. And I think you get to learn so much through, you know, this amount of time that you have that you would otherwise never really learn how to do those things. But when you were living in the UK with your family, were you actually starting to learn all these dishes from your mom growing up?
To be honest, not really. So when I was growing up, I spent first 11 years of my life in KL. And my mom was a sort of housewife, so she used to cook us fantastic, you know, just normal, like two vegetables and a meat dish or, you know, with soups and things for dinner. And so I grew up watching her cook. I wasn't necessarily cooking with her. Like she's like a lot of Asian moms, you know, like the kitchen is her thing. But I definitely remember like sitting on the, like the floor or the high chair, just looking up. And it's funny, I think I must have picked up a lot from just osmosis. Then I went to university, studied law, like, and didn't really cook that much after that when I started working as a lawyer. Like at uni, I was cooking simple stuff like stir fries and curries and things. But when I was a practicing lawyer, I just didn't have the time. And that's honestly why I burnt out after nearly a decade. And, you know, I was good at it, but I was just working crazy hours. And at that time, I realized, look, I can work this hard for something that I really care about and really want to do. I was a corporate lawyer. So so many of my clients had set up their own businesses. And I thought, you know, I just turned 30. Why not me? I try. You know, I'd rather try and fail than never try at all and regret.
Yeah.
So it was during that time when I took some a few months off to figure out how I could change my life and the direction. I spent a lot of time then with my mum, so going like cooking with her. And I said to her, look, mum, today you're going to teach me, I don't know, bak kut teh. And I would just stand right next to her. And, you know, like most mums, again, is all very aga-aga. And she just cooks from memory. And, you know, sometimes the dish will come out slightly different because she's forgotten something, you know. So I just, I stood next to her. And before she would put any seasoning in to whatever she's cooking, I'd stop her hand, physically stop her hand, measure it, and write it down. And then she can continue. So it's, that time also was very, it helped me to rebuild, and reconnect with me and my soul, and, made me realize how important like heritage and Malaysia was, and the cooking, especially to me, like, you know, food has always been, central to my life. Like even when I was at university or as a lawyer, everyone used to ask me, oh, where should we go and eat, or, you know, like for restaurant recommendations, because I've always loved food. So so it's, I guess it's, life takes you funny directions, but in the end, you know, you sort of, yeah, as you get older, I think you learn to listen to yourself more. That's how I came to it.
Yeah, it's so ironic that you said that you were experiencing burnout. That's why you wanted to leave the industry and you started your own restaurant, which is even more stress and even more hours.
Yeah, I mean, in a different way. I think, yes, of course, it's I probably work the same amount of hours, or, you know, work the same amount, but I have control of my time and I get to, schedule my days according to how I want to live. For example, you know, like today, this morning, we're having this chat, and then I'm going to go out for lunch with my parents, hopefully. And then in the afternoon, I come back and do a bit more work. So it's things like that where, you know, it's, I'm not being pulled in different directions. And my life literally is all about this business, about my food. And it's very simple now.
Yeah. And how did your parents take to the news that you wanted to open a restaurant?
Well, of course, you know, like, when I first changed, they were very worried, you know, like, and they said to me, oh, but but do you want to open a restaurant? Do you want to write a cookbook? And I said at that time, I didn't know. All I knew was I had to try something. And I started off in street food because in like 2012, 2013, the street food scene in London was really like exploding. It was really massive at that time. And there were so many other amazing sort of food entrepreneurs in the street food scene at that time. And of course, you know, for Southeast Asia, street food is massive. So I thought, okay, let's try this. And also it required the least capital to start up. So I created the chicken satay burger. At that time, it's pretty unique here. And because I did all my market research, I went to, you know, physical markets around London. And I was like, you know, analyzing the stalls and seeing what people were buying. And of course, you know, we're in the West, like the most popular stall all the time was the burger stall. And that's why I thought, okay, why don't I make like a Malaysian style burger, hence chicken satay burger. And I, at that time, I also made beef rendang and put it in like, you know, brioche as well. And so it's just, again, suck it and see. And I learned from scratch how to run a food business. So how to run a simpler street food stall operation. Then over time, my customers will ask me, the street food customers will say, yeah, can you please open a restaurant? Because we want to come and eat your food when it's not raining, it's not cold, it's not snowing. And can you also make laksa? I never even considered doing laksa in a street food stall setting because it requires so much liquid, right? So, and hence the laksa bar pop-up restaurant was born. And so I did that for a couple of years of all around London. So, and it was incredibly successful. You know, we did a 2-week residency, for example, right at the start in a North London suburb in one of my friend's restaurants. 2 weeks, dinner time only, at the beginning of January, which is traditionally very bad for restaurants. And I thought, oh gosh, no one's going to come. But literally, there were queues every night because we were no reservations. One night was snowing and there's queues. And I'm like, okay, there's something with laksa. So, and that's, you know, I just followed that route and opened a restaurant in 2018. And again, like, you know, it's like crawl, walk, and then run. And running the laksa bar as a pop-up restaurant allowed me to learn how to, for example, scale up my recipes, how to manage a kitchen, how to manage front of house. You know, I can do every single job in my restaurant, but that's no longer my job. So, you know, and so it hasn't really happened overnight. It's like, it's been a steady sort of, yeah, a journey, if you like.
And how did you curate the menu at your restaurant? Did you think about what would people gravitate towards? I mean, the kind of food that they were most exposed to on their travels? Or did you try to sneak in some dishes that, you know, are not that popular in the West and people are a little bit unfamiliar with?
Well, for example, I mean, laksa that seemed to really resonate with people. So I tried to build, for example, the snacks around the laksa with things that were, again, conceptually easy for people to understand. For example, fried chicken. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone loves fried chicken. Like, if you say you don't like chicken, you're lying. Again, like, with, you know, we're in London, so you can't have, it's very difficult to run like a proper satay, like charcoal grill outdoors. It's never going to happen. So again, I found a way of converting those flavors into something that I could sell in an indoor setting. Then another one of our very popular snacks is actually my take on gado gado salad. Like, that's not really that well known, but I wanted a vegan vehicle for our peanut sauce. Like, you cannot ignore dietary requirements in the UK, and you know, it's just I like to be able to welcome and include everyone in the restaurant. So again, like gado gado salad in sort of Southeast Asia, it can be quite a substantial dish. You know, you got eggs, you got tofu, potatoes, but at the restaurant, I stripped it down and made it a smaller portion because I wanted it to be a lighter take on it. Still really tasty, but It's just sort of evolved over time. And now, like, for example, we've got the curry puffs, fenugreek crackers as well. They're actually Indian methi puri, which, you know, I really love. To be honest, I've probably never had them in, I don't remember having them in Malaysia, but I wanted for the restaurant a vegan version of a prawn cracker that we made in-house. You know, so it's just, it's stuff like that that people would understand and recognize as something, you know, that they might have had a version of somewhere else, but it's all unique to me and the restaurant.
Yeah, and what is your approach to veganizing or making something that's so meat-heavy or seafood-heavy, like a laksa or like, say, a nasi lemak?
You know, I just have a couple of very simple substitutions. For example, we have a vegan laksa. Mm-hmm. But so instead of the shrimp paste and habi, we use miso paste and tomato puree. Like, again, you know, very heavy in umami, but very simple substitutions. And same, like, if you want to make a vegan sambal, you know, try using those two things, or maybe just plain salt. It's not that hard once you, you know, once you get over the fact that, okay, there's just no meat products at all. Or for example, yes, oyster sauce, of course we use it all the time, but now you can get like the mushroom sauce, stir fry sauce, it's everywhere, right? So just very simple things. Or for example, one of our very popular desserts is a set coconut pudding, which is my take on a panna cotta. I love panna cotta. But instead of the gelatin, we just use corn flour, you know, like it's not hard once you start to sort of think about it and have a few basic substitutions, which I do talk about in the book as well.
Yeah, I find that so interesting because if you go back to Singapore or Malaysia, you would never find a hawker who would even think about veganizing his dishes.
Because you don't need to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so many people are not vegetarian in Singapore and Malaysia. But I feel that, you know, it's so great that we are able to, you know, inject all these dishes with new twists and new perspectives and make it more relevant to a bigger group of people. So on a more personal front, I would love to ask you if you ever felt a sense of imposter syndrome. You know, I know that a lot of people, when they move out of a country and they live abroad for a period of time, they do feel a sense of a need to kind of prove themselves that they are as Malaysian or as Singaporean as people who didn't leave the country. Did you ever feel that way?
To be honest, not really. I've always been quite confident in like, my taste memories. Like, you know, I'm so lucky to have had the first few years of my life in Malaysia and to remember, you know, like family banquets or like so Chinese New Year and my Bobo's house and stuff like that, as well as, you know, like big seafood banquets where you go, all the men would go and choose the fish and stuff like that. And of course, the hawker centers and coffee shops. And of course, like one of the main memories for me is that primary school, like, you know, like the massive school canteen with so many different options, like freshly cooked food. And I had laksa practically every day for lunch, you know, at school. So, all this really helped to formulate my identity, I think, when I came to the UK. And I've just sort of hung on to that really very tightly. And I've been lucky, of course, to have my immediate family, my parents and my brother here with me. So when we came over, at least I could still have my mother's cooking and she still continued to, you know, roll out like really great family meals for us, even though we couldn't go to the hawker stores anymore. But, you know, she still carried on that tradition. And in London, actually, again, so I was lucky because we've always had not many, but a few like Malaysian restaurants in London. So like most weekends, we continued the family tradition. We'd go off and, you know, like so many of Southeast Asians, we travel for miles. Like we're happy to travel an hour to go and try some restaurant. And so, you know, the food continued to play a very important part in my life. So in that sense, I'm not, I don't feel any imposter syndrome. And that's just what I know. And again, you know, it's like, if people don't like my food, then, well, that's sort of their problem. It's like, you know, I like what I do, and my main MO is to make sure everything that I serve is tasty, and that's about it, really, you know? So, yeah.
Yes, I love that confidence. I would love to know about Iban cuisine in your cookbook. So when I read that, I was like, what is this? I've never ever heard of this before. So can you tell me what it is? And also, how were you exposed to it?
Like, okay, I am in no way an expert in Iban cuisine or culture, just putting it out there, okay, making it very, very clear. I was, again, very lucky to have, like, the last time I was in Malaysia, I was very privileged to be able to go on this very, very special exclusive trip organized by a great friend of mine, Dr. Anna Sulan Massing, whose father is sort of Iban, and it's a very big tribe in Sarawak. So she organized a trip for us there, and I'd never been to Borneo full stop before this trip, which is very shameful as a Malaysian, you know, like, you know, why do we not go there? It's like, it's right next door and we should know about it. And so she took us to upriver from Cebu to Kapit. It's like a 3-hour longboat journey. Fascinating. And we actually got to spend time in an Iban longhouse, you know, and with the people, and have experience their hospitality. So, you know, we were like, we were plied with tuak, which is like coconut spirit. And it's just, you know, just one of those magical experiences that is really informative. And so I just picked up a few things, like, for example, you know, they don't really live in the city. It's the, you know, their back garden is the jungle. So they go and forage, and sort of the seasonings are a bit simpler than what I'm used to, because, you know, it's just using, like, for example, lemongrass or ginger, galangal, daun kasum, laksa leaves, chilies a bit. It's so much, much simpler than sort of the food that, like, for example, Nonya cooking or like even some Chinese cooking, like pongte, is quite strong flavors. So that, you know, I have a couple of dishes in the book dedicated to that trip, like my take on manok panso, which is a sort of very typical Sarawakian dish. But again, it's my take on it. It's not the traditional recipe, because I added stuff to it that I thought worked well. And also Sarawak butter prawns. Like Anna's family took us to this amazing Fujian Chinese restaurant where, like, butter prawns, like in mainland, like from KL, like in my head, butter prawns are like, you know, the with the egg floss,
yeah,
and the curry leaves.
Yeah, I
love that. But here in Sarawak, it was completely different. It's like with a sort of sweeter sauce, like butter, super garlic sauce, which was delicious. So it was just fascinating to learn about the differences, slight differences in the cuisine just across the water.
Why was it so important to you to have these recipes in the book? You know, I saw that you had the word diversity repeated quite a few times throughout the introduction. So why was that so important to you?
To try to explain to people, I mean, what Malaysian food is, you know. And I do think one reason why our food is not as well documented or known in the West is because it is quite complex, in that, you know, you've got all the different cultures which feed into our food, as well as the geography. You've got Thailand and Indonesia. You've got being colonized as well. So I'm just trying to show a very broad range of dishes and some ideas to explain, like, why our food is how it is. Like, for example, one of my favorite recipes from my mom is her Hainanese pork chop, you know, with sort of onion sauce, and it's basically like, you know, like a British gravy, right? So it's things like that, just to try to convey the history of various dishes. And it's not just about curries or the laksa or there's just so much more.
And what do you think is the current perception of Malaysian cooking globally? I mean, in the world or in the UK?
I think people are extremely receptive to our flavors mm-hmm. and sort of strong, punchy flavors. And also, like, you know, because especially now when we haven't been able to travel so much, like, definitely people want something different. And once I explained to people, look, if you're comfortable making a stir fry or making a curry or a stew, you can absolutely cook Malaysian food. It's not magic. You know, and also once you have like the few basic pantry ingredients, like coconut milk, chilies, lemongrass, shrimp paste, of course, belacan and tamarind paste. Yes, I admit, like, belacan and tamarind paste are more unusual ingredients. But again, we're so lucky to live in a connected, like, you know, world where so much is available online. So, you know, it's becoming more possible. And again, like, I try in the book to say, okay, if you can't find belacan, use hebi, for example, or maybe like fish sauce. Or, so it's just, hopefully the book conveys, like, okay, this is just a guide, but if you don't have one or two ingredients, it's okay, it's still going to taste good. You know, you just have to play around with the seasonings. And like, one thing I tried really hard to do was make sure that every recipe had sufficient seasoning to make it taste decent, you know, because a lot of recipes say, oh, season to taste, but how is anyone who's never had the food know what it's supposed to taste like, you know? So yeah, it's just little things like that to make sure that, okay, you can cook this recipe as it is and it's going to taste good. Mm. But you can, you know, put less chilies or, you know, make it vegan. Or it's completely up to you where you go with the recipes.
Yeah. So, you know, now in Singapore, actually, a lot of people are not cooking heritage food because they find it so laborious. Even if they live back home where they have all the different ingredients and herbs ready for them and it's so cheap, they don't want to cook it because it's so much effort. So I was just wondering if you feel that Malaysian cooking is accessible.
I think so. Of course it is. You know, like, honestly, like, half the meals I make every week are sort of Malaysian or, you know, sort of Asian inspired, because, like, we have the basic ingredients already, you know, like the basic sauces, I don't know, like soy sauce, oyster sauce, bean paste, you know. It's really not that hard once you commit yourself to just knowing a few basic things. Mm-hmm. I do find it a shame if you're only cooking, like, you know, I don't know, pastas or more convenient stuff. Like, I'm a very big believer in batch cooking. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like, I don't know, at the weekends, like, my husband and I will just cook like a lot of something and we might eat it a couple of times during the week, you know. I'm very fine with leftovers. Like, of course, I love leftover rice because that means I can have fried rice the next day. So things like that, I definitely think is accessible. And certainly, I think COVID has made people more interested in cooking sort of here. Like, I don't know how it's been like in Australia or Southeast Asia, but definitely, yeah, people want to experiment more and to come up with different things for their you know, daily meals.
In Singaporean cooking, it's a lot about frugality and not throwing things away, you know. So we would reuse things like prawn shells, prawn heads. We would fry them, make it into a stock. Pork fat, we would turn that into crispy lard croutons. Yeah, so I think that really underpins the kind of food that I have been eating when I was living in Singapore. What do you think is the overarching ethos of Malaysian cooking?
For me, it's more about, like, incredibly tasty flavors made from very little sometimes. Similar to what you're saying, there is a big reliance on, for example, like chilies and bean paste, soy sauce, like strong umami flavors, belacan, you know, which you can't have our cuisine without those things. So again, like having these basic sources of pantry items just helps you to make our food.
One last question. What is your dream, or what are you working towards, or what's on the horizon for you?
Well, I in the immediate future is having an actual baby, a human baby, which is going to be a brand new chapter in my life. I'm slightly terrified. But after that, so just continue with my mission in life, which is to introduce as many people to Malaysian food as possible. And, you know, getting them to understand it's really simple to cook, and to get them to travel to the region and to further explore, you know, what it is and our cuisine and our lifestyle, and to understand, you know, why it's so different. You know, like I keep saying to people, in Malaysia, you can eat anything any time of day, at, you know, like literally anything. We eat like at least 6 times a day, you know, smaller portions, but it, like, it's just completely different to what we experience here. And to just spread that joy. I hope to be able to grow my restaurant and open more sites, certainly in London. Maybe, I don't know, maybe one day I'll write another cookbook. Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, it's all, you know, like I said, it's all, I go along and I see what happens, and I grab opportunities as they arise, or as they take my fancy. But definitely, you know, Malaysian food and cooking is in my life plan forever.
Yeah, I think you are such an inspiration, because you are like such a go-getter, and you are so confident in yourself and your own cooking. And also, I think you set the benchmark so high for anyone who wants to share about our food to a global platform. I am so happy for the success of your book. And, you know, it's just a shining beacon for a lot of us.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, but likewise yourself, like, you know, everything that you cook is so amazing. And like, you know, what you're doing is really incredible, because you're showing things that are like, I would love to cook. Like the other day you cooked muruku. I love that stuff. Like, you know, it's just like, I get so much joy from your platform. So thank you very much. And I guess like the main thing I want to say to people is like, don't be afraid. You know, just do it, like what you have done. You know, it's just like it, and finding those pieces of joy in life is so important, and to feed your soul. And if cooking does that, then, you know, for goodness sake, like, go with it, you know, in some way. It's better to have tried and figured out you don't like something. It's not failure. It's really not. Sometimes you have to go through an incredibly bad, difficult time to understand, okay, that's not how I need, that's not what I need to do. And you take a different route, you know, so like one door closes, another opens. So I do think there is merit in following your passion in a way, but also like understanding your limits and knowing when to cut your losses, of course, and to change direction. Like, you know, if it's not working, yeah, like, don't stop doing it. Like, obviously, like, life is for living, and that's definitely something that I'm really proud and pleased that I've managed to do with my life, and to just take a different route, perhaps than what I thought I would when I was 18 years old. It's just really listening to yourself and believing in yourself as well.
Totally agree. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and for spending your morning with me. You know, I am so eager to finish reading your whole cookbook.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I hope you enjoy it, and keep on cooking.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to Mandy In of Sambal Shiok in London and author of the cookbook Sambal Shiok. Food media tends to focus on Singapore's best hits like chicken rice or laksa and fails to capture the diversity of Singaporean food. By documenting overlooked recipes, Singapore Noodles seeks to share about Singapore's rich food culture with you. If you'd like to support the work that we do, sign up to be a member on our website, sgpnoodles.com. You'll gain access to all of the recipes on the site and participate in monthly cook-alongs. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you next week.